Sooner or later, the railroads were bound to run out of settlers, long before they ran out of land. Then it became a problem of moving the more intrepid ones westward so that others could fill their places. The strategy used most often had to do with the effects of Western climate on health. In 1871, the Union Pacific described the climate throughout eastern Kansas as genial and healthy. With irresistible logic, the railroad asked, "What doth it profit a man to buy a farm if he and his family lose their health?" That was enough to bring pioneers from the malarial swamps of Louisiana. 11 years later, when eastern Kansas was filling up with settlers and 5 million acres of Union Pacific land remained unsold at the other end of the state, the climate in eastern Kansas suddenly turned unhealthy. For their own benefit, the railroad began advising settlers to get to the higher elevations of the state. Meanwhile, in Europe, an enormous harvest of souls was waiting to be converted. Western railroad agents frequently showed up in port cities, where they held court under striped awnings and dazzled groups of murmuring listeners with claims they wouldn't dare utter in the States. Swedes, who seemed to have a tendency toward homesickness, were promised a free passage back to Europe if they returned to port with a small quota of relatives in tow. The steamship companies, which were having trouble filling their expensive ships, partly because they had a chronic inclination to explode, were happy to cooperate. When a new ship docked in New York Harbor, the mob of land sales agents rushing aboard was like a migration in reverse. The terms of sale, 10% down, 7% interest alone required for the first 3 years, could have been regarded as usurious, since deflation was the chronic economic ailment of the time. But terms like this were not to be found in Europe. Neither, for that matter, was land. The number one allies of the railroads in their efforts to bring settlers to the West were the politicians, newspaper editors, and territorial jingoists who were already there. No one excelled William Gilpin in this role. Gilpin, who had been a member of John C. Fremont's expedition to Oregon in 1843, was the prototypical 19th-century Renaissance man of the American West. Soldier, philosopher, orator, lawyer, geographer, governor, author, windbag, and booby. In an essay, "Geopolitics with Dew on It," published in Harper's Magazine in 1943, Bernard DeVoto called Gilpin's thinking typical of what passed in 19th-century America for science. A priori, deduced, generalized, falsely systematized, and therefore wrong. He might have added, dotty. Imagining himself in space, Gilpin saw the North American continent as a vast amphitheater opening toward heaven, an enormous continent-wide bowl formed by the Rockies and the Appalachian ridges, which was ready, as far as Gilpin was concerned, to receive and fuse harmoniously whatever enters within its rim. A capitalist expansionist mystic, as only the 19th century could offer up, Gilpin thundered to a meeting of the Fenian Brotherhood in Denver. "What an immense geography has been revealed! What infinite hives of population and laboratories of industry have been set in motion! North America is known to our own people. Its concave form and homogeneous structure are revealed." The hives of population of which Gilpin spoke were the 1,310,000,000 people who, he was convinced, could fit comfortably within his continental bowl, and because they could fit, then it was weakness of will to settle for anything less. Obviously, a desert has no place in such a galvanic vision. "The plains are not deserts," Gilpin shouted in one of his books, which was modestly titled "The Continental Railway, Compacting and Fusing Together All the World's Continents," "but the opposite, and the cardinal basis for the future empire now erecting itself upon the North American continent." Empire was a passion with Gilpin, as it was with his mentor, Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. Benton, in addition to being the father of John C. Fremont's wife, was the father of Manifest Destiny, which was to become the rationalization for those excesses that its companion doctrine, social Darwinism, could not excuse. While Benton sat in Missouri flogging pioneers westward, Gilpin stood in Colorado welcoming them and shrieking for more. And there was no scarcity of Bentons and Gilpins in the states between. Kansas's Board of Agriculture was reporting a statewide average of 44.17 inches of precipitation in 1888 and 43.99 inches in 1889. It has never rained that much in Kansas since. There was also a Kansas Bureau of Immigration, which announced that the climate in Kansas was, without exception, the most desirable in the United States. Summer might linger into November, and then, at the close of February, we are reminded by a soft, gentle breeze from the south that winter is gone. At the same time, a story began to circulate among disillusioned settlers about a mule standing in a field of Kansas corn. It grew so hot that all the corn around him began to pop, and mistaking it for a blizzard, he froze to death. Nebraska had its Bureau of Immigration, too, which specialized in isothermal belts. These were longitudinal and latitudinal bands within which, by natural laws, the most advanced muscular and mental development, as well as the most heroic achievement of invention and creative genius, were invariably produced. The most significant isothermal belt in America ran right through Nebraska. As evidence, you had only to look at Colorado, which was farther south and west and full of dirty Spaniards and Indians. Coloradans, of course, shrugged off this type of thing. They were busy describing their own miracles. Capitalists, newspaper editors, lonely pioneers, local emperors of Gilpin's ilk, all had a stake in retreating deserts. But they were not the only ones. Abolitionists, for example, did too. In the 1850s, when Kansas seemed likely to be the next state admitted to the Union, something approaching warfare broke out between those who would have made it a free state and those who would have tolerated slavery. Horace Greeley, an avowed abolitionist with considerable interest in the West, found the climate in Kansas wonderful and the rainfall abundant. In such a state, Greeley said in his influential editorials, a 160-acre homestead could produce an ample living. A plantation, of course, demanded more land. But if Kansas was full of yeoman farmers working 160-acre plots, plantations and slaves were not likely to intrude. 160 acres. If anything unifies the story of the American West, its past and its present, its successes and its dreadful mistakes, it is this mythical allotment of land. Its origins are found in the original Homestead Act of 1862, which settled on such an amount, a half-mile square, more often referred to as a quarter section, as the ideal acreage for a Jeffersonian utopia of small farmers. The idea was to carve millions of quarter sections out of the public domain, sell them cheaply to restless Americans and arriving immigrants, and by letting them try to scratch a living out of them, develop the nation's resources and build up its character. In the West, the Homestead Act had several later incarnations: the Desert Lands Act, the Timber Culture Act, and the Timber and Stone Act were the principal ones. Neither Congress nor the General Land Office, which was responsible for administering the acts, could ever comprehend that the relative success of the land program east of the Mississippi River had less to do with the perseverance of the settlers or the wisdom of the legislation than with the forgiving nature of the climate. In the East, virtually every acre received enough rainfall, except during years of extraordinary drought, to grow most anything that didn't mind the soil and the temperature. Unlike much of the West, which suffers through months of habitual drought, the East gets precipitation year-round. In the spring and early summer, when crops need water most, much of the East is exceptionally wet. Since the growing season, except in the extreme north, was at least 5 months long, even an ignorant or lazy farmer could raise some kind of crop. In the West, even if you believed that the rainfall was magically increasing, you still had to contend with high altitudes, the Western Plains, the Snake River Valley, and most of the irrigable lands in the Great Basin would float over the tops of all but the highest Appalachian mountains, and, as a result, chronic frost danger even in May and September. Then there were the relentless winds, hailstones bigger than oranges, tornadoes, and breathtaking thunderstorms. There were sandy lands that would not retain moisture, and poorly drained lands that retained too much. There were alkali lands that poisoned crops. The General Land Office bureaucrats sat in Washington pretending that such conditions did not exist. Their job, as they perceived it, was to fill little squares with people. They extended no credit, provided no water, offered no services. And the permutations of the Homestead Act that found their way into the Western versions of the law sometimes added to the farmers' burdens. Under the Timber Culture Act, for example, you had to plant one quarter of your quarter section with trees, a stipulation inserted because it was thought that trees increased the rainfall. In West Texas, where, meteorologically speaking, all that is predictable is the wind, you would have to spend most of your time replanting your fallen down trees. Under the Desert Lands Act, which applied to lands so arid even the government realized that farming was hopeless without irrigation, you had to demonstrate proof of irrigation before you could own the land. Unless you owned reasonably flat land immediately adjacent to a relatively constant stream, which did not, as most western rivers do for much of their length, flow in a canyon, complying with the Desert Lands Act was almost out of the question. A mutual irrigation effort by the inhabitants of a valley was, perhaps, a possibility. That was what the Mormons had done, but they were a close-knit society linked by a common faith and a history of persecution. The members of Congress who wrote the legislation, the land office agents who doled out land, and the newspaper editors who celebrated the settlers' heroism had, in a great many cases, never laid eyes on the land or the region that enclosed it. They were unaware that in Utah, Wyoming, and Montana, to pick three of the colder and drier states, there was not a single quarter section on which a farmer could subsist, even with luck, without irrigation, because an unirrigated quarter section was enough land for about five cows. The Indians accepted things as they were. That is why they were mostly nomadic, wandering toward greener grass and fuller herds and flowing water. If whites were going to insist on living there, fixed, settled, mortgaged, fenced, the best they could do with the land was graze it. But in those three states, an economical grazing unit was, say, 2,500 to 5,000 acres, depending on the circumstances. To amass that much land, you had to cheat on a magnificent scale. If you didn't, you had to overgraze the land and ruin it. And many millions of acres were damaged or ruined in exactly this way. Many settlers were tasting property ownership for the first time in their lives, and all they had in common was greed. Speculation, water monopoly, land monopoly, erosion, corruption, catastrophe. By 1876, after several trips across the plains and through the Rocky Mountain states, John Wesley Powell was pretty well convinced that those would be the fruits of a Western land policy based on wishful thinking, willfulness, and lousy science. And by then, everything he predicted was happening, especially land monopoly, water monopoly, graft, and fraud. Homesteads fronting on streams went like oranges aboard a scurvy-ridden ship. The doctrine of riparian rights, which had been unthinkingly imported from the East, made it possible to monopolize the water in a stream if you owned the land alongside it. But if the stream was anything larger than a creek, only the person who owned land upstream, where it was still small, could manage to build a dam or barrage to guarantee a summer flow. Then he could divert all he wanted, leaving his downstream neighbors with a bed of dry rocks. Riparian doctrine alone, therefore, made it possible for a tiny handful of landowners to monopolize the few manageable rivers of the West. When their neighbors saw their predicament and sold out, they could monopolize the best land, too. As for the Desert Lands Act and the Timber and Stone Act, they could not have promoted land monopoly and corruption more efficiently if they had been expressly designed for that purpose. A typical irrigation scene under the Desert Lands Act went as follows. A beneficiary hauled a hogshead of water and a witness to his barren land, dumped the water on the land, paid the witness $20, and brought him to the land office, where the witness swore he had seen the land irrigated. Then, with borrowed identification and different names, another land application was filed and the scene was repeated. If you could pull it off 6 or 7 times, you had yourself a ranch. Foreign sailors arriving in San Francisco were offered a few dollars, a jug of whiskey, and an evening in a whorehouse in exchange for filing a land claim under the Timber and Stone Act. Before shipping out, the sailors abdicated title. There were no restrictions on transfer of ownership. Whole redwood forests were acquired in such a manner. Then there was a Swamp Lands Act, or Swamp and Overflow Act, a Desert Lands Act of the bulrushes. If there was federal land that overflowed enough so that you could traverse it at times in a flat-bottomed boat, and you promised to reclaim it, which is to say, dike and drain it, it was yours. Henry Miller, a mythical figure in the history of California land fraud, acquired a large part of his 1,090,000-acre empire under this act. According to legend, he bought himself a boat, hired some witnesses, put the boat and witnesses over county-sized tracts near the San Joaquin River where it rains, on the average, about 8 or 9 inches a year. The land became his. The sanitized version of the story, the one told by Miller's descendants, has him benefiting more from luck than from ruse. During the winter of 1861 and 1862, most of California got 3 times its normal precipitation, and the usual semi-arid Central Valley became a shallow sea the size of Lake Ontario. But the only difference in this version is that Miller didn't need a wagon for his boat. He still had no business acquiring hundreds of thousands of acres of the public domain, yet he managed it with ease. One of the unforeseen results of the homestead legislation was a high rate of employment among builders of birdhouses. In most instances, you were required to display an erected domicile on your land. The Congress, after all, was much too smart to give people land without requiring them to live on it. In a number of instances, the erected domicile was a birdhouse, put there to satisfy a paid witness with a tender conscience. It is quite possible that the greatest opportunity offered by the homestead legislation in the West was the opportunity to earn a little honest graft. By conservative estimates, 95% of the final proofs under the Desert Lands Act were fraudulent. Whole townships have been entered under this law in the interest of one person or firm, thundered Binger Herman, a commissioner of the General Land Office, about the Timber and Stone Act. Not long afterward, Herman himself was fired for allowing unrestricted fraud. Mark Twain might have written it off to the human condition, but Powell, who subscribed to a more benevolent view of humanity, wrote it off to the conditions of the desert and the failure to understand them. Americans were making a Procrustean effort to turn half a continent into something they were used to. It was a doomed effort. Even worse, it was unscientific. The document that Powell hoped would bring the country to its senses was called A Report on the Lands of the Arid Region of the United States with a More Detailed Account of the Lands of Utah. Published in 1876, the volume was 7 years in preparation, though Powell took time out for a second expedition down the Colorado in 1871 and for his usual plethora of intermittent pursuits. Powell's report is remarkably brief, a scant 200 pages in all. Unlike many of his rivals, such as the bombastic Ferdinand V. Hayden, Powell was more interested in being right than in being long. But his portrait of the American West has revolutionary implications even today. At the beginning, Powell reconfirmed his view, which he had already submitted to an unbelieving Congress, that 2/5 of the United States has a climate that generally cannot support farming without irrigation. On top of that, irrigation could reclaim only a fraction of it. When all the waters running in the streams found in this region are conducted on the land, Powell said, there will be but a small portion of the country redeemed, varying in the different territories perhaps from 1 to 3%. Powell regarded the theory that increased rainfall accompanied human settlement as bunk, but typically he disposed of it in a sympathetic and felicitous way. If it be true that increase of the water supply is due to increase in precipitation, as many have supposed, the fact is not cheering to the agriculturist of the arid region. Any sudden great change in climate is ephemeral, and usually such changes go in cycles, and the opposite or compensating change may reasonably be anticipated. We shall have to expect a speedy return to extreme aridity, in which case a large portion of the agricultural industries of these now growing up would be destroyed. The whole problem with the Homestead Acts, Powell went on, was that they were blind to reality. In the West, a 160-acre irrigated farm was too large, while a 160-acre unirrigated farm was too small. Most Western Valley soil was fertile, and a good crop was a near certainty once irrigation water was applied. In the milder regions, the growing season was very long, and two crops were possible, so one could often subsist on 80 irrigated acres or less. That, in fact, was about all the irrigated land one family could be expected to work. Remove the irrigation water, however, and things were drastically different. Then, even a whole section was too small a piece of land. Under most circumstances, Powell claimed, no one could make a living through dryland ranching on fewer than 2,560 acres, four full sections. And even with that much land, a settler's prospects would be dicey in times of drought, because the land might lie utterly bare. Therefore, every pasturage farm should ideally have a water right sufficient to irrigate 20 acres or so during emergencies. Having thrown over the preeminent myths about agriculture in the American West, Powell went on to the truly revolutionary part of his report. Under riparian water law, to give everyone a water right for 20 irrigated acres was impossible if you gave everyone a neat little square of land. Some squares would contain much greater stream footage than others, and their owners would have too much water compared with the others. The property boundaries would therefore have to be gerrymandered to give everyone a sufficient piece of the stream. That was one way you could help avert the monopolization of water. Another way was to insist that people use their water rights, not hold on to them in the hope that cities would grow up and one could make a killing someday selling water to them. An unused water right should revert, let us say after 5 years, to the public trust so someone else could claim it. Doing all this, Powell reasoned, might help assure that water would be used equitably, but not necessarily efficiently. Ideally, to get through drier months and times of drought, you needed a reservoir in a good location, at a low altitude, and on the main branch of a stream. That way, you could get more efficient storage of water. A dam only twice as large, but lower down, might capture 5 times as much water as a smaller one upstream. Also, you could then irrigate the lower valley lands, which usually have better soil and a longer growing season. In any event, an on-stream storage reservoir was, from the point of view of irrigation, preferable to small, shallow ponds filled with diverted stream water, the typical irrigation reservoirs of his day. The ponds evaporated much greater amounts of water and displaced valuable cropland. But who, Powell asked, was building on-stream reservoirs? Practically no one. Homesteaders couldn't build them at all, let alone build them right, nor could groups of homesteaders, unless perhaps they were Mormons. Such dams required amounts of capital and commitment that were beyond the limits of aggregations of self-interested mortals. Private companies probably couldn't build good irrigation projects either, nor even states. Sooner or later, the federal government would have to get into the irrigation business or watch its efforts to settle the West degenerate into failure and chaos. Once it realized that, it would have to undertake a careful survey of the soil characteristics so as not to waste a lot of money irrigating inferior land with drainage problems. And, he implied rather than stated, the government ought to put J.W. Powell in charge. The General Land Office, which would otherwise be responsible, was, as anyone could see, a gigantic illustration of the evils of badly directed scientific work. Having gone this far, Powell figured he might as well go the whole route. Fences, for example, bothered him. What was the sense of every rancher enclosing his land with a barbed wire fence? Fence lands tended to be unevenly grazed, and fences were obvious hazards to cattle in winter storms. Fencing was also a waste of time and money, especially in a region where rainfall could skid from 20 to 6 inches in successive years, and someone was lucky to survive at all, let alone survive while constantly repairing and replacing fences. Individually fenced lands were a waste of resources, too. It took a lot more tin, Powell reasoned, to make 5 8-ounce cans than to make 1 40-ounce can. The sensible thing was for farms to be clustered together, and the individually owned lands treated as a commons, an ejido, with a single fence around the perimeter. States bothered Powell, too. Their borders were too often nonsensical. They followed rivers for convenience, then struck out in a straight line, bisecting mountain ranges, cutting watersheds in half. Boxing out landscapes, sneering at natural reality, they were wholly arbitrary and therefore stupid. In the West, where the one thing that really mattered was water, states should logically be formed around watersheds. Each major river, from the glacial drip at its headwaters to the delta at its mouth, should be a state or semi-state. The great state of Upper Platte River. Will the senator from the state of Rio Grande yield? To divide the West any other way was to sow the future with rivalries, jealousies, and bitter squabbles whose fruits would contribute solely to the nourishment of lawyers. While Powell knew that his plan for settling the American West would be considered revolutionary, he saw a precedent. After all, what was the difference between a cooperative irrigation district and a New England barn raising? One was informal, the other organized and legalized, but otherwise they were the same thing. Communal pasture lands might be a gross affront to America's preoccupation with private property rights, but they were common in Europe. In the East, where inland navigation was as important as irrigation was in the West, you already had a strong federal presence in the Corps of Engineers. If anything was revolutionary, it was trying to graft English common law and the principles and the habits of wet zone agriculture onto a desert landscape. There was not a desert civilization in the whole world where that had been tried, and most of those civilizations had withered, even after following sensible rules. Powell was advocating cooperation, reason, science, an equitable sharing of the natural wealth, and, implicitly, if not explicitly, a return to the Jeffersonian ideal. He wanted the West settled slowly, cautiously, in a manner that would work. If it was done intelligently instead of in a mad, unplanned rush, the settlement of the West could help diffuse the dangerous conditions building in the squalid industrial cities of the East. If it was done wrong, the migration West might go right into reverse. The nation at large, however, was in no mood for any such thing. It was avid for imperial expansion, and the majority of its citizens wanted to get rich. New immigrants were arriving, dozens of boatloads a day, with that motive burning in their brains. To them, America was not so much a democratic utopia as a gold mine. If monopolists reigned here, they could accept that. Someday they would be monopolists too. 40 years earlier, Alexis de Tocqueville had captured the raw new country's soul. To clear, to till, and to transform the vast uninhabited continent which is his domain, the American requires the daily support of an energetic passion. That passion can only be the love of wealth. The passion for wealth is therefore not reprobated in America, and, provided it does not go beyond the bounds assigned to it for public security, it is held in honor. In Powell's day, that passion for wealth had, if anything, grown more intense. A pseudo-scientific dogma, social Darwinism, had been invented to give predatory behavior a good name. Darwin could not be taught in the schools, but a perversion of Darwin could be practiced in real life. The unpeopled West, naturally, was where a great many immigrants hoped to find their fortunes. They didn't want to hear that the West was dry. Few had ever seen a desert, and the East was so much like Europe that they imagined the West would be too. A tiny bit semi-arid, perhaps, like Italy. But a desert? Never. They didn't want to hear of communal pasture lands. They had left those behind, in Europe, in order that they could become the emperors of Wyoming. They didn't want the federal government parceling out water and otherwise meddling in their affairs. That was another European tradition they had left an ocean away. Agricultural fortunes were being made in California by rampant capitalists like Henry Miller. Acreages the size of European principalities were being amassed in Texas, in Montana. If the federal government controlled the water, it could also control the land. And then the United States might become a nation of small farmers after all, which was exactly what most Americans didn't want. For this was the late 19th century, when, as Henry Adams wrote, the majority at last declared itself, once and for all, in favor of the capitalistic system with all its necessary machinery, the whole mechanical consolidation of force, ruthlessly created monopolies capable of controlling the new energies that America adored. It was bad enough for Powell that he was pulling against such a social tide. He also had to deal with the likes of William Gilpin, who had traded his soapbox for the governor's mansion in Denver. He had to fight with the provincial newspapers, the railroads, and all the others who were already there and had a proprietary interest in banishing the great American desert. He had to deal with Western members of Congress who could not abide anyone calling their states arid, although 100 years later, when the Bureau of Reclamation had become their prime benefactor, members of Congress from these same states would argue at length over whose state was the more arid and hostile. Powell seemed, at first, to have everything going in his favor. The West was coming hard up against reality, as more hundreds of thousands of settlers ventured each year into the land of little rain. His exploits on the Colorado River had made him a national hero, the most celebrated adventurer since Lewis and Clark. He was on friendly, if not intimate, terms with a wide cross-section of the nation's elite, everyone from Henry Adams to Othniel C. Marsh, the great paleontologist, to Carl Schurz, the Interior Secretary, to Clarence King, the country's foremost geologist, to numerous strategically placed members of Congress. By 1881, he was head of both the Bureau of Ethnology and the Geologic Survey, two prestigious appointments that made him probably the most powerful, if not the most influential, scientist in America. But none of this prestige and power, none of those connections, was a match for ignorance, nonsense, and the 19th century's fulsome, quixotic optimism. When he testified before Congress about his report and his irrigation plan, the reception from the West, the region which he was passionately involved, the region he wanted to help, was icily hostile. In his biography of Powell, Wallace Stegner nicely characterized the frame of mind of the typical Western booster politician when he surveyed Powell's austere, uncompromising monument of facts. What, they asked, did he know about the West? What did he know about South Dakota? Had he ever been there? When? Where? For how long? Did he know the average rainfall of the James River Valley or the Black Hills? Did he really know anything about the irrigable lands in the Three Forks country in Montana? They refused to understand his distinction between arid and subhumid. They clamored to know how their states had got labeled arid and thus been closed to settlement. What about the artesian basin in the Dakotas? What about irrigation from that source? So he gave it to them. Artesian wells were and always would be a minor source of water as compared to the rivers and the stormwater reservoirs. He had had his men studying artesian wells since 1882. If all the wells in the Dakotas could be gathered into one county, they would not irrigate that county. Senator Moody of South Dakota thereupon remarked that he did not favor putting money into Major Powell's hands when Powell would clearly not spend it as Moody and his constituents wanted it spent. "We ask you," he said in effect, "your opinion of artesian wells. You think they're unimportant. All right, the hell with you. We'll ask somebody else who will give us the answer we want. Nothing personal. The result, in the end, was that Powell got some money to conduct his irrigation survey for a couple of years, far less than he wanted and needed, and then found himself frozen permanently out of the appropriation bills. The excuse was that he was moving too slowly, too deliberately. The truth was that he was forming opinions the West couldn't bear to hear. There was inexhaustible land, but far too little water, and what little water there was might, in many cases, be too expensive to move. Having said this, held to it, and suffered for it, Powell spent his last year in a kind of ignominy. Unable to participate in the settlement of the West, he retreated into the Bureau of Ethnology, where his efforts, ironically, helped prevent the culture of the West's original inhabitants from being utterly trampled and eradicated by that same settlement. On September 23, 1902, he died at the family compound near Haven, Maine, about as far from the arid West as he could get. Powell had felt that the Western farmers would stand behind him, if not the politicians themselves. There he made one of the major miscalculations of his life. Apparently, he underestimated the capacity of the plains dirt farmer to continue to believe in myths even while his nose was being rubbed in unpleasant fact, Stegner wrote. The press and a good part of the public in the West was against him more than he knew. The American yeoman might clamor for government assistance in his trouble, but he didn't want any that would make him change his thinking. What is remarkable, 100 years later, is how little has changed. The disaster that Powell predicted, a catastrophic return to a cycle of drought, did indeed occur, not once, but twice, in the late 1800s and again in the 1930s. When that happened, Powell's ideas, at least his insistence that a federal irrigation program was the only salvation of the arid West, were embraced, tentatively at first, then more passionately, then with a kind of desperate insistence. The result was a half-century rampage of dam building and irrigation development which, in all probability, went far beyond anything Powell would have liked. But even as the myth of the welcoming, bountiful West was shattered, the myth of the independent yeoman farmer remained intact. With huge dams built for him at public expense and irrigation canals, and the water sold for 0.25 cents per ton, a price which guaranteed that little of the public's investment would ever be paid back, the West's yeoman farmer became the embodiment of the welfare state, though he was the last to recognize it. And the same Congress, which had once insisted he didn't need federal help, was now insisting that such help be continued at any cost. Released from the need for justification, released from logic itself, the irrigation program Powell had wanted became a monster, redoubling its efforts and increasing its wreckage, both natural and economic, as it lost sight of its goal. Powell's ideal was a future in which the rivers of the American West would help create a limited bounty on that tiny fraction of the land which it made sense to irrigate. It is hard to imagine that the first explorer of the Colorado River would have welcomed a future in which there might be no rivers left at all. Chapter 2. The Red Queen. While Los Angeles moldered, San Francisco grew and grew. The city owned a superb natural harbor, the best on the Pacific coast, one of the best in the world. When gold was struck in the Sierra Nevada foothills, 150 miles across the Central Valley, San Francisco became the principal destination of the fortune-seekers of the world. The names of the camps suggested the potency of the lure. New York of the Pacific, Bunker Hill, Chinese Camp, German Bar, Georgia Slide, Nigger Hill, Dutch Corral, Irish Creek, Malay Camp, French Bar, Italian Bar. Those who found their fortunes were inclined to part with them in the nearest haven of pleasure, which was San Francisco. Those who did not discovered that they could do just as well providing the opportunities. With oranges going for $2 apiece at the mines and a plate of fresh oysters for $20 or more, it was a bonanza for all concerned. In 1848, the population of San Francisco was 800. 3 years later, 35,000 people lived there. In 1853, the population went past 50,000, and San Francisco became one of the 20 largest cities in the United States. By 1869, San Francisco possessed one of the busiest ports in the world, a huge fishing fleet, and the western terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad. It teemed with mansions, restaurants, hotels, theaters, and whorehouses. In finance, it was the rival of New York. In culture, the rival of Boston. In spirit, it had no competitor. Los Angeles, meanwhile, remained a torpid, superating, stunted little slum. It was too far from the gold fields to receive many fortune seekers on their way in, or to detach them from their fortunes on the way out. It sat forlornly in the middle of an arid coastal plain, lacking both a port and a railroad. During most of the year, its water source, the Los Angeles River, was a smallish creek in a large bed. During the few winter weeks when it was not, when supersaturated tropical weather fronts crashed into the mountains ringing the basin, the bed could not begin to contain it, and the river floated neighborhoods out to sea. For many years, Santa Anita Canyon near Pasadena held the United States record for the greatest rainfall in a 24-hour period, but it may be more significant to state that the 26 inches that fell in a day were nearly twice the amount of precipitation that Los Angeles normally receives in a year. Had humans never settled in Los Angeles, evolution, left to its own devices, might have created in a million more years the ideal creature for the habitat, a camel with gills. The Spanish had actually settled Los Angeles long before they ever saw the Golden Gate. It was more convenient to Mexico, and from an irrigation farmer's point of view, it was a more promising place to live. By 1848, the town had a population of 1,600, half Spanish and half Indian, with a small sprinkling of Yankees, and was twice the size of San Francisco. A decade later, however, San Francisco had grown 10 times as large as Los Angeles. By the end of the Civil War, when San Francisco was the Babylon of the American frontier, Los Angeles was a filthy pueblo of 13,000, a beach for human flotsam washed across the continent on the blood tide of the war. One of the town's early pioneers, a farm boy whose family had immigrated from Iowa, described it as a vile little dump, debauched, degenerate, vicious. If anything could be said to have saved Los Angeles, it was its reputation as a haven from persecution, a place where one could lose oneself. Since the ranks of the persecuted include those who are too virtuous for their fellow citizens, as well as those who are not virtuous enough, sooner or later the city was bound to attract the victims of mobocracy. And the most persecuted among the virtuous in 19th-century America were, besides peaceful Indians and runaway slaves and Mennonites and Quakers, the members of the Mormon faith. After fleeing Illinois for Utah, the Mormons had always been obsessed with finding escape routes to the sea. The first irrigation canals were still being dug beside the Wasatch Range when Brigham Young dispatched a party of his most loyal disciples in 1851 to follow Jedediah Smith's old route to the coast. When they crossed the San Bernardino Mountains, they found themselves in a huge arid basin that reminded them of home and was only a day or two from the sea. The streams were less reliable than those in Utah. The southern mountains received a scantier snowpack that never lasted halfway through the summer. But the San Bernardinos got decent winter rain, and artesian wells below them flowed like geysers. With money earned by selling food and supplies at usurious prices to adventurers bound through Utah for the gold fields, the Mormons purchased a huge chunk of land from an old Spanish rancho. The soil was good, the climate was ideal, and no one was better at irrigation farming than Mormons. Before long, they were supplying much of the basin with food. In 1857, the U.S. cavalry marched on Utah, and Brigham Young ordered all distant settlements abandoned, but the Mormons' achievement had left its mark. A Presbyterian colony was soon established nearby, then a Quaker colony, then an ethnic colony of Germans. In this freakish climate, semi-tropical but dry, ocean-cooled but lavishly sunny, you could grow almost anything. Corn and cabbages sprouted next to oranges, avocados, artichokes, and dates. The capitalists of San Francisco did not remain oblivious. The Southern Pacific ran a spur line to Los Angeles in 1867, finally linking it to the rest of the world. On the same line, huge San Bernardino Valencias found their way to the 1884 World's Fair in New Orleans, where they attracted crowds. No one could imagine oranges grown in the western United States. It was then and there, more or less, that the phenomenon of modern Los Angeles began. They came by ship, they came by wagon, they came by horse. They came on foot, dragging everything they could in a handcart, but the real hordes came by train. In 1885, the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad linked Los Angeles directly with Kansas City, precipitating a fair war with the Southern Pacific. Within a year, the cost of passage from Chicago had dropped from $100 to $25. During brief periods of mad competition, you could cross two-thirds of the continent for a dollar. If you were asthmatic, tubercular, arthritic, restless, ambitious, or lazy, categories that pretty well accounted for Los Angeles's first flood of arrivals, the fares were too cheap to pass up. Out came Dakota farmers who despaired at the meager profits they made growing wheat. You could grow oranges! Out came Civil War veterans looking for an easy life, failures looking for another chance. And the usual boomtown complement of the slick, the sharp, and the ruthless. The first boom began in the early 1880s and culminated in 1889, when the town transacted $100 million worth of real estate, in today's economy, a $2 billion year in Idaho Falls. Fraud was epic. Hundreds of unseen, paid-for lots were situated in the bed of the Los Angeles River or up the 9,000-foot summits of the San Gabriel Range. The boom was, predictably, short-lived. In 1889, a bank president, a newspaper publisher, and the town's most popular minister all fled to Mexico to spare themselves jail terms, and a dozen or more victims took their own lives. By 1892, the population had dropped by almost one-half, but the bust was followed quickly by an oil boom, and enough fortunes were being made. The original Beverly Hillbillies were from Beverly Hills, then a patch of jackrabbit scrub overlying an oil basin, to pack the arriving trains again. Los Angeles soon drew close to San Francisco in population and was crowing with glee. The busting of the boom became but a little eddy in the great stream, enthused the Los Angeles Times, the intermission of one heartbeat in the life of the most charming land on the footstool of the Most High, the most beautiful city inhabited by the human family. Only one thing stood in the way of what looked as if it might become the most startling rise to prominence of any city in history, the scarcity of water. The motives that brought Harris and Gray Otis, Harry Chandler, and William Mulholland to Los Angeles were the same that would eventually bring millions there. Otis came because he had been an incontrovertible, if not quite ignominious, failure. He was born in Marietta, Ohio, and as a young man held a series of unspectacular jobs, a clerk for the Ohio legislature, a foreman at a printing plant, and editor of a veterans magazine. His one early taste of glory came during the Civil War, in which he fought on the Union side, acquired several wounds and decorations, and ultimately rose to the rank of captain. Captain Harrison Gray Otis. He liked the title well enough to think himself deserving of a sinecure, and after the war he drifted out to California in search of one. What he got was an appointment as government agent on the Seal Islands, some frigid, treeless, wind-blasted humps of rock in the Bering Sea. His chief duty there was to prevent the poaching of walrus and seals, an assignment that suited Otis better than he knew, since he bore an odd resemblance to the former and had a disposition to match. He was a large, blubbery man, with an intransigent scowl, an Otto von Bismarck mustache and a goatee, and a chronic inability to communicate in tones quieter than a yell, whether he was debating the American role in the Pacific or telling someone to pass the salt. He is a damned cuss who doesn't seem to feel well unless he is in a row with someone, one among his legions of enemies would later remark. The Seal Islands post was a humiliation that Otis, who was more ambitious than he was clever, couldn't afford to pass up. But after 3 years he had had enough, and he returned, bilious and frustrated, to California, where he got a job as editor of a local newspaper in Santa Barbara. Otis hated Santa Barbara. It was a hangout of the privileged classes, smug, snobbish, and perfectly content to remain small. Otis despised inherited wealth and class, but he despised a town that was disdainful of growth even more. He believed in it, perfervidly, just as he believed in those who started with nothing and dynamite their way to success. Hustlers, men of brain, brawn, and guts, were the people he admired most, even if he had less in common with them than he thought. Otis would pursue a sinecure as a greyhound chases a rabbit, and it was his rotten luck at it, more than anything else, that finally caused his success. Trying to get himself appointed Marshal of California, he was offered the job of consul in Tianjin, an insult that was more than he could bear. In 1881, Otis quit the paper in Santa Barbara and moved his family to Los Angeles. The city was still small when Otis arrived, but it was already served by several newspapers, one of which, the Times and Mirror, was owned by a small-time Eastern financier named H.H. Boyce. Boyce was looking for a new editor, and, though the pay was a miserable $15 a week, Otis took the job. Perhaps because he was fuming about the pay, or perhaps because he knew that time was running out, Captain Otis then made one of the bolder decisions of his life. He took all of his savings and, to help offset the low pay, convinced Boyce to let him purchase a share in the newspaper. Privately, he was thinking that someday, perhaps, he could force H.H. Boyce out. Harry Chandler came to Los Angeles for his health. He grew up in New Hampshire, a cherubic child with cheeks like freestone peaches. His falsely benign appearance, which stayed with him all his life, made him a popular boy model among advertisers and photographers. But cherubic Harry was a rugged individualist and a ferocious competitor, and if there was money involved, he would rarely pass up an opportunity or a dare. While at Dartmouth College, he accepted someone's challenge and dove into a vat of starch, a display that nearly ruined his lungs. Advised by doctors to recuperate in a warm and dry climate, he bought a ticket to Los Angeles. Arriving there, he moved from flop house to flop house, because none of his fellow tenants could endure his hacking cough. When he was thoroughly friendless and nearly destitute, Harry met a sympathetic doctor who suffered from tuberculosis and owned an irrigated orchard near Cahuenga Pass at the head of the San Fernando Valley. Would Harry like a job picking fruit? The work was hard but invigorating. Before long, Harry felt almost cured. The work was also surprisingly lucrative. The doctor was as uninterested in money as Harry was interested, and let him sell a large share of what he picked. In his first year, Harry made $3,000. It was a small fortune, and inspired in Harry an awed faith in the potential of irrigated agriculture, and most particularly, agriculture in the San Fernando Valley. With the proceeds, Harry began to acquire newspaper circulation routes, which at the time were owned independently of the newspapers and bought and sold like chattel. Before long, he was a child monopolist, owning virtually all the routes in the city. By 1886, Harrison Gray Otis had finally managed to hound H.H. Boyce out of the Los Angeles Times and Mirror. It was a pyrrhic victory, however, because Boyce had immediately established a rival paper, the Tribune, and engaged Otis in an all-out circulation war. With the allegiance of whoever dominated the circulation routes, one or the other was certain to win. It was Otis's luck that he got Harry Chandler first. Within days, the Tribune began to disappear mysteriously from people's doorsteps, and its delivery boys simultaneously contracted a contagion. Meanwhile, new subscribers began to flock like moth-scenting pheromones to the Times. Boyce was broken within months. Before Otis had much chance to gloat, however, he learned that the defunct Tribune's printing plant had secretly acquired a new owner, whose name was Harry Chandler, and that the tactics they had used together against Boyce could just as easily be turned against the times. Otis, who bore lifelong grudges over provocations infinitely smaller than this, was realistic enough to know when he was had. Besides, this mild-appearing young man was the embodiment of every quality he admired. As a result, the Times acquired a new circulation manager and guiding light whose name was Harry Chandler. And in 1894, Harry Chandler acquired a new father-in-law whose name was Harrison Gray Otis. William Mulholland came to Los Angeles more or less for the hell of it. He was born in 1855 in Dublin, Ireland, where his father was a postal clerk. At 15, he signed on as an apprentice seaman aboard a merchant ship that carried him back and forth along the Atlantic trade routes. By 1874, he had had enough and spent a couple of years hacking about the lumber camps in Michigan and the dry goods business in Pittsburgh, where his uncle owned a store. It was in Pittsburgh that Mulholland first read about California. He had just enough money to get to Panama by ship, and after landing in Colon, he traversed the isthmus on foot and worked his way north aboard another ship, arriving in San Francisco in the summer of 1877. Being back on a ship had renewed Mulholland's taste for the sea, and after a brief failure at prospecting in Arizona, where he also fought Apaches for pay, he decided to ship out at San Pedro, the port nearest Los Angeles. He had $10 to his name. Anxious to make a little extra money, he joined a well-drilling crew. We were down about 600 feet when we struck a tree. A little further we got fossil remains. These things fired my curiosity. I wanted to know how they got there, so I got hold of Joseph LeConte's book on the geology of the country. Right there, I decided to become an engineer. In his official photograph for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which was taken when he was nearly 50, Mulholland still looks young. He is wearing a short-brimmed dark fedora and a dark pinstripe suit. A luxuriant silk cravat circumnavigates a shirt collar that appears to be made of titanium. From a thick, bushy mustache sprouts a lit cigar. The face is supremely Irish. Belligerence in repose, a seductive, churlish charm. Once, in court, Mulholland was asked what his qualifications were to run the most far-flung urban water system in the world, and he replied, "Well, I went to school in Ireland when I was a boy, learned the 3 R's and the 10 Commandments, most of them, made a pilgrimage to the Blarney Stone, received my father's blessing, and here I am." He began his engineering career in 1878, as a ditch tender for the city's private water company, clearing weeds, stones, and brush out of a canal that ran by his house. One day Mulholland was approached by a man in a carriage who demanded to know his name and what he was doing. Mulholland stepped out of his ditch and told the man that he was doing his goddamn job and that his name was immaterial to the quality of his goddamn work. The man, it turned out, was the president of the water company. Learning this, Mulholland went to the company office to collect his pay before being fired. Instead, he was promoted. The Sierra Nevada blocks most of the weather fronts moving across California from the Pacific, so that a place on the western slope of the range may receive 80 inches of precipitation in a year, while a place on the east slope, 50 miles away, may receive 10 inches or less. The rivers draining into the Pacific from the west slope are many and substantial, while those emptying into the Great Basin from the east slope are few and generally small. The Owens River is an exception. It rises southeast of Yosemite, near a gunsight pass that allows some of the weather to come barreling through, heads eastward for a while, then turns abruptly south and flows through a long valley, 10 to 20 miles wide, flanked on either side by the Sierra Nevada and the White Mountains, which rise 10,000 feet from the valley floor. The valley is called the Owens Valley, and the lake into which the river empties, used to empty, was called Owens Lake. Huge, turquoise, and improbable in a desert landscape, it was the shrunken remnant of a much larger lake that formed during the Ice Ages. Due to a high evaporation rate, and, for its size, a modest rate of inflow, the lake was more saline than the sea, but it supported two species of life in the quadrillions, a salt-loving fly, and a tiny